I'm Cheryl Corley, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Well, it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about whatever is in the news and whatever is on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for Shape Up this week, our opinion writer and blogger, Jimmy Israel, University of Texas professor Ed Dorn, editor Eugene Robinson, and writer Terrence Samuel. I know the guys have a lot to talk about. A local NAACP chapter gets involved in the Michael Vick case. Is that really a good idea? And the Reverend Al Sharpton is getting a new zip code. Also, Hillary and Obama take the gloves off in the political ring. And the military uses new incentives to get some recruits. I may jump in from time to time, but for now, take it away, Jimmy.
Hey, fellas. What's up? Welcome to the shop. How's everybody doing?
Hey, nice, Jimmy.
Good nice. To talk with you, Jimmy.
Check this out. Let's kick things right off talking about the local chapter of the NAACP in Atlanta jumping up to suggest a rush to judgment of accused dogfighter Mike Vick. Now, on the one hand, yes, there is due process. But on the other hand, the NAACP, perhaps more relevant these days than ever, should pick their battles wisely. Terrence, is this the media trying to mistreat Vick?
I don't think so. You know, I think the more the NAACP gets into stuff like this, the more ridiculous they look. Michael Vick is a rich man. Michael Vick doesn't need the NAACP to defend him, especially not in court against some indictment on dogfighting charges. I mean, you know, dogfighting, he wants to do it. I don't think it's a good idea. Let him defend himself in court. If he walks, then good for him. But this is not a civil rights issue.
Right. Yeah, you know, but you know what, Ed, he says that he had no idea. I mean, because he's a rich man. And Terrence pointed that out. I mean, he's got a lot of property. Does NAACP have any business, you know, sticking up for Vic?
Well, I'm guessing that the defense of the downtrodden and the indigent and the poor, I guess they've taken care of all those cases and they can start working on helping multimillionaires who allegedly are fond of dog killing. They've been adrift for years, and this is you know, a further evidence of the fact that somebody there doesn't know what's going on, idea what's going on.
Let me just jump in real quick. Haven't they been involved in the Gennaro Wilson?
Okay, well, every now and again, you know, they hit the right button, but they never hit it hard enough. I mean, yeah, of course they were involved with Gennaro Wilson, but in my opinion, that's a case, C-Love, where he's kind of right and he's kind of wrong. I mean, you shouldn't be videotaping yourself having sex with young ladies.
Of course, Gennaro is the 17-year-old football player who was sent to prison in Georgia after being arrested for inappropriate sexual acts with a younger teenager at a New Year's Eve party.
The subtext here is that, you know, somehow this is... there's some racial element to this.
Right, there's some great wrong to a black man, right?
And you could see, you could make the argument that the criminal justice system in a Gennaro Wilson case is acting the way it always has with black men. Michael Vick, not so much.
Go ahead.
If Brett Favre had killed a dog, the reaction would be very much largely the same. So why is the NAACP there?
Yeah, I think that's right. But the other thing is that Michael Vick is very important, symbolically in other ways, to the Atlanta community and especially to the black community in Atlanta. So it's very fine, I think, appropriate for the NAACP to say, hey, wait a minute, let's not rush to judgment. Let's not convict the guy in a court of public opinion before he's convicted elsewhere. I think they went a little bit too far, though, as I understand that the head of the NAACP in Atlanta also said, let's boycott Nike and all those other commercial entities, and that part of it is silly.
Well, check this out. Here's what I say about it. Just like OJ, if Vic didn't do it, he knows who did, and I hope that brother's got a good lawyer. Anyway, okay, moving on. Oh, snap, look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Al Sharpton headed to Chicago to help fight the cause of police misconduct.
Now, wait a second. Landing in the city of the broad shoulders.
Now, check this out. Last I heard, that's Jesse Jackson's territory. So from the curb, that sounds a lot like a circus with one clown too many. Now, Eugene, why in the world does Al Sharpton have to chase down every racial injustice?
Well, as a native New Yorker, I appreciate him taking his act on the road, believe me. But I think that Jesse, mostly on account of being a new father, is probably not able to... Ooh, did I say that? is maybe can't get after it the way he used to. So, you know, the special secret ring gets punched and Al flies out to Chicago. I don't think it's an equipment issue at all, you know.
It's the black signal. You know, Terry, what's up with Al Sharpton?
As is so often the case with Al, you know, there's some real stuff here and then there's the surreal stuff.
Right.
The real stuff is that black people in America still have this problem with police brutality. We have a lot of platforms, and not everybody's talking about it. Al's talking about it, and God bless him for that. When he goes to Chicago, mm-hmm. you know, he gets a level of attention that nobody else is getting or nobody else feels the need to pursue. And a lot of people who don't have any other leverage than to just mm-hmm. get, you know, the circus with the one clown kind of uses it. The debate about whether Al is on Jesse's turf, I'm going to leave to the surrealist.
Well, this is Cheryl just jumping in again.
Because this is Cheryl's turf.
Right, right, right.
And,
go ahead, Cheryl.
And I just have to say that the Reverend Jackson said that he mentored Al Sharpton, so he doesn't have any problem with him coming into town.
Yeah, Reverend Sharpton learned advocacy from Jesse Jackson when he worked for Operation Breadbasket. He learned his theatricality from the Godfather of Soul, James Brown. It is hard to beat that pedigree if you want to learn to stand on stage and excite a bunch of people. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, one of the most dangerous places in the world to be is standing between Al Sharpton and a television camera.
Okay, well, yeah, all right, well, check that out. Now, Ed, here's me. I'm wondering, now, you're the older head in the room. You're the wiser head in the room. And I'm wondering how a nation of black people ever put their faith in a man with a perm. How did that happen, bro?
That's the James Brown influence, isn't it?
I don't have
the foggiest idea, but the man has sort of a mixed record. But listen, he's trying to establish mm-hmm. some kind of national organization. Mm-hmm. The move to Chicago, big market, big media market, big town, makes sense, and he may not be welcome in Mayor Bloomberg's office nowadays, so moving to Chicago and helping out Mayor Daley makes sense.
Well, I don't know what Mayor Daley has to say about that. This is what his spokeswoman said. She said the mayor and Reverend Sharpton spoke by phone and that both men have many of the same aims, and that was just about that.
Well, check this out, everybody. Here's me. As far as I'm concerned, Al Sharpton should shut up and retire gracefully from whatever he does for a living, because I don't think anybody's sure.
Jimmy, before we
leave... Go ahead, Ed. I'm sorry.
You ask the question, why are black people keeping this guy afloat? And I argue that it is the white media who are keeping him afloat. He's a guy who is more quotable than he is knowledgeable, but nevertheless, it is the media that run to him every time an incident happens, and as I said, Al is really ready with a quip, and he is ready and eager to stand before a television camera.
Before you move on, Jimmy, I just want to let everybody know that they're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and I'm Cheryl Corley. We're listening to Jimmy Israel, Eugene Robinson, Ed Dorn, and Terrence Samuel for this week's Barbershop. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Thank you, C-Love. Yo, Ed, that's a point well made, but so, I mean, you've just described every homeless bum in America. You know, I mean,
as a native New Yorker, I'd like to defend Al Sharpton for one second. Sharpton came out, if you remember, New York was in a very different place than it is now, and he was a trenchant voice from the community that was willing to speak out on a variety of issues as the Giuliani administration in New York was starting, and it was nice, and it was refreshing, you know.
So he was relevant once upon a time. Okay, well.
He was relevant once upon a time.
Okay, well, let's move forward. Let's talk about the military doling out signing bonuses for new enlistees, paying people $20,000 if they sign up and ship out in short order. Ed, tell me, has it come to this?
Jimmy, are you under 35? Are you ready to sign up? Listen, for an 18-year-old, that's pretty attractive. Makes sense for the Army, because they can turn the spigot on, turn it off, whatever they want to.
Right.
And if they find that they're making their quotas, they're trying to recruit 80,000 people this year, if they find that they're on target for that, they'll just turn that bonus off.
Well, it seems exploitive to me. Terrence, how do you see it?
That's good American money. Are you kidding? There are a lot of people who, 10 years past the cutoff date, who would take that money.
Your life is worth $20,000, right? I mean, on the side, I mean, it's like, hey, I need a quick $20,000. I'm going to go get on the front lines. You know, give me a break. Come on.
The war is going to hell.
Absolutely.
And that's why they got to pay people to do it. And the result is that you get people who are in financial straits who find this attractive. you could see down the road, if you extrapolate mm-hmm. this, that you're going to have an army that's essentially made up of working class and poor people who are doing it for the cash. And if you can go to college, it's not that new. And you get right down
to it. So basically, what you're saying to me, T. Sam, is that the same people that work at the post office are the same people that are going to end up in the army, right?
It used to be that people did this stuff for their country, and they took
right, Terrence, go ahead.
They took the money. Mm-hmm. Now you have, 67% of the country saying the war is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. The country's on the wrong track. The patriotic appeal is not an attractive one.
You know what? The military has always preyed upon the poor. As far as I'm concerned, it's hit a new low. But, let's kick it on the political and look at how Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have a disagreement, and the media just blows into this full-scale fracas now. Terrence, is this a tempest in a teapot, or is there a real political point to all this media instigation?
I think Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama at some point were going to have to engage. They didn't go out and raise $58 million each just to have nice tea parties. They're getting ready for war. They both had a little piece of this this pie, and somebody was going to have to take a shot. Hillary saw her chance. She took it. I think Obama came back and ended up not being hurt by this. And also, I think, more importantly, displayed a willingness to go after her that I think is going to serve him well going forward.
So, Eugene, it sounds a lot like what Terrence is saying is what L. Spencer said some time ago, is that Hillary needs to prove that she can, that she doesn't have to fight like a girl. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the long play on this is that mm-hmm. what they're jockeying for right now is who's going to run for the president and who's going to run for the vice president. So mm-hmm. you want to fight a strong campaign, but you don't want to get things so deeply into angry territory that you can't. So this is an impossibility. I think these two can fight a spirited campaign, and I think it's mm-hmm. much less for Hillary about fighting like a girl. I mean, I don't think Hillary's fought like a girl ever. So.
And I know some tough girls who can fight now, if you're going
No, that's not my implication.
My implication is that she's been a wild
knuckle fighter from the beginning. So
there is some substance here. And the nice thing is that in the end, they're both right. The question mm-hmm. that they've been arguing about now for 2 weeks was, would you be willing to meet without precondition with all these nasties in the world, Fidel Castro, Ahmadinejad, and so on? And Barack Obama said, yes, he would be willing without condition. Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. basically qualified that and said, look, you don't meet just to meet. You have to have an agenda, and that's going to take time. Eventually, they can pull those two things together. The two are easily reconciled.
Here's what I think. I think it's a cheap way to sex up the political debate, and yo, I'm not biting. Fellas, check it out. It's about that time. Want to thank you all for showing up. I got to kick it over to C. Love, who's stepping in for Michelle Martin.
Yes.
C. Love?
Well, Jimmy Israel joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. He's an opinion writer and blogger. Eugene Robinson is a senior editor for McLife magazine. He joined us from the Sports Byline studios in San Francisco. Ed Dorn is a professor of public affairs at the University of Texas. He joined us from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. And Terrence Samuel is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect magazine. He joined us here from our studios in Washington, D.C. You can find links to all of our barbershop guests at our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yep.